You know, when Dana was sharing about the testimony of Jesus, I don't know if you ever saw this ad on television. It's for Brawny Towels. And all these kids are misbehaving, and this lady is all frustrated in the front and trying to get them to behave, and they're throwing food around, and then Brawny shows up at the window. And she doesn't see him. And these kids, all of a sudden, they all straighten up and they're all doing great. And she thinks she does something. And that's what I thought, you know, as it's a little servant of God in the front, and then all of a sudden he stands behind you. Well, let's apply our indispensable principle, and then we'll look to the trust the Lord to speak to us. Our Father, we do wait upon Thee again now and ask You to minister to our hearts. We praise You for the prophetic word, but we ask for the prophetic word made more sure by the testimony of Christ. We come to this book as a lamp shining in a dark place, but we do pray for the day star to rise in our hearts. Manifest Thyself, we pray. Find us where we are. Take us where You'd have us. We ask in Jesus' matchless name. Amen. Okay, we won't spend a lot of time in review, but just enough to get the message. Again, the theme, the great purpose, the heart of God in this book before us again. When God gives a message in the prophets, in the Bible, but especially it applies to the prophets, He always addresses a crisis. He always addresses an emergency. He meets a present need. And more than half the battle in understanding the prophets, minor prophets, major prophets, is having God discover to your heart what is that crisis that He is meeting. If you can identify that need, very often then the revelation of Christ in that regard will begin to loom and shine forward. In Habakkuk, the crisis is not right on the surface. You look for the historical background, usually the crisis is connected with that. And when you come to the book of Habakkuk, you don't see that historical background. And you don't really have a lot of historical information. And since it's vital to understand the crisis, and since the only thing we really have is the prophet himself, it's logical to look for that crisis in his life, in his personal life. And when you do, I think you'll see that that is exactly where it is. And the message of the book is in meeting that crisis. And in the case of Habakkuk, what a crisis it is. What a tremendous need. His life was being eaten away by negative thoughts about his own faith. He was absolutely convinced that he was the greatest unbelieving believer in the world. That there was no one else who just entertained. He thought he was unique. And he just had all of these struggles with his faith. It was a personal crisis. It was raging in his heart. And the whole book is around that crisis. The book, as I shared last evening, is in the form of a prayer. The first two chapters are just a dialogue between the Lord and him. He's pouring out his heart. It finally ends up with a song in chapter 3. But it's that he has many questions. The answers to his questions aren't the answer to his question. And since the answers are not really the answers, God digs beyond all of the questions that he has in order to answer his life, in order to answer his heart. Habakkuk is just troubled that he has questions. And he's troubled that he has doubts. In other words, other people just seem that they can trust in the Lord without a struggle. And some have different measures of faith and ability to grip the Lord. His name means, they think, embrace. And all he wants to do is embrace God. He wants to embrace the Lord, but here he's struggling. And in chapter 1, it's a good chapter, Steve, for you to study if you want to see depression. Because, boy, chapter 1 is full of depression. And he has really hit a bottom. You'd never believe, as you go through the book, that the man in chapter 1 is the same man that's in chapter 3. And even more of a surprise, I think, to discover that the faith in chapter 1 is the same faith that's singing in chapter 3. God does not give Habakkuk anything in this book except eyesight. He ends up the same way he started. He started with faith, but he didn't know he had faith. He thought it was unbelief, and it brought him to a depression. All God did was show him that what he thought he didn't have, he had. And when he saw that he had what he wished, he broke into song. And God then transformed him, and the rest of the story, I think, will be applied in our own lives, I hope. All right, so this is what we're looking at. This struggling faith that's real faith. The difference between struggling faith and unbelief is willingness to believe. The desire. I want to be willing to believe. And when he sees that that's accepted by God and that God's pleased with it, then he breaks into song. When you're convinced in your heart, and I don't know, perhaps there's someone like that. When you're convinced in your heart that you have no faith, it's almost like nobody can deal with you. Because you got 1,001 reasons why you know you have no faith. Habakkuk was like that, and Habakkuk was so convinced that he was an unbeliever that he begins giving God his reasons why he's an unbeliever. I know I don't have faith because God then begins to deal in the life of Habakkuk and show him the very arguments that he's using to prove he has no faith. In reality, prove that he has faith. That's what I'd like us to look at this morning, to begin to look at. Suffering faith is faith. It's real faith. Struggling faith that has a desire to believe is still faith. And may God give us grace to see this. I don't want to give any comfort where God's trying to convict. But if God's trying to comfort someone who's really battling this, I don't want to question, I don't want to have these doubts. If you have real faith, then God wants you to know that you have real faith, and that'll produce a song. All right, I suggested on the surface that what it looked like, the theology problem, was his real problem. God doesn't deal with the occasions of your problem. God always deals with your problem. His theology was the occasion for his real need. His problem was a lot deeper than, I can't reconcile God's ways with my logic. That was his theology problem. But his real problem was deeper than that. Glance again, please, at chapter 1, 1 to 4. I'm not going to read it again. His theology was this unjudged sin. Can't God see all that's going on? Is God blind? Is God deaf? Why doesn't God answer? Look at the wickedness. Look at the injustice. Look at the strife. Look at the suffering, and so on. Now, as Habakkuk approaches God And he says, God, why are you countenancing all of this? Why are you allowing all of this? That question, and this is important if you'll understand Habakkuk, that question and the answer to that question is not his problem. It's deeper than that. It's amazing how God bypasses your questions in order to answer your life. You'll see that as you go on, as you pray to God. He may not answer the words of your mouth, because He answers the cry of your heart. And sometimes you're not able to verbalize the cry of your heart. And so God bypasses the prayer of a moment to answer the prayer of a life. And God bypasses the verbalization of what you think your problem is in order to answer your life. And when He cries in verse 6, when God says, I'm raising up the Chaldeans, and He describes from 7 to 11 these terrible Chaldeans. The occasion of his problem was he couldn't reconcile a holy God taking a more sinful nation. That's his theology. But his real problem was underneath that. And that's what God is going to answer. And that's what we need to look at. For those that like logical connection, here's the outline. Let me show you four arguments that Habakkuk presents to God to convince God that he has unbelief. So common, so everyday. And if this applies in our lives, then may God set us free from these things. Habakkuk thought his faith was unbelief, number one. He was frustrated because he was carrying a burden. And carrying that burden was proof to him because he was always so bothered, because he was under that burden and he felt lousy, and Christians are supposed to feel good. And there's a joy and he didn't have joy and he was just carrying this burden. He said, I must be an unbeliever because I'm so burdened. Usually we start Habakkuk in our head with verse 2, not verse 1. And you're only in the second verse, and you read verses 2 to 4, and you're already up to your earlobes in his burden. He doesn't even build up to it. He just starts right out crying. Remember, you're looking in the prayer closet. And he just begins, I'm burdened. I'm oppressed. All I see is sin. Sin, sin, sin. Everywhere I look, I go to my window, I see sin. I see injustice. I go to the fellowship, and nobody can get along, and everybody's fighting. I see sin. And I go to my life, and I see sin. And all I see is sin, sin, sin. How can I be happy? I must be the biggest unbeliever. The things that bother me aren't bothering other people. And I'm just under this burden, day and night. And I know I'm not supposed to have a burden. And I pray about my burden, and God doesn't seem to do anything. And so that's his first argument. If I was a victorious Christian, would I be under a burden? Victorious Christians don't have any burden. But the book doesn't begin in chapter 1, verse 2. The chapter begins in chapter 1, verse 1. The oracle, the burden, King James again comes through. The burden, verse 3, thou dost make me see iniquity. And God begins to show Habakkuk that the burden that was depressing him, convincing him that he was an unbeliever, came from God. The oracle, the burden which God showed him. You know, we often misquote or misunderstand Psalm 37:4. Delight yourself in the Lord and He'll give you the desires of your heart. We usually think that means He'll give you anything you want. That isn't what it says. It's teaching that when you have real faith, even if it's struggling faith, that the desires you have, where'd you get them? You desire certain things. Where'd you get that desire? He gives you the desires of your heart. He puts those on you. Psalm 55:22. Cast your burden on the Lord, and He'll sustain you. And in the margin of the new ASB, the true version, it's only kidding. In the margin of the new ASB, right next to the word burden, cast your burden on the Lord. There's a footnote, and it says literally, what He has given you. What's a burden? Cast your, what He has given you on the Lord. What's a burden? A burden is what God puts on you in order that you might put it on Him. God puts a burden on you. You know, God never burdens anybody to burden them. God never burdens anyone to frustrate them. When God is about to do something, when God's about to work, when God is going to move, He looks for a vessel. It's right in there. When God's about to work, He looks for a vessel. Someone that He can burden. Or some group that He can burden, that He can lay a heaviness on. Many Christians, I think, fall into the snare that Habakkuk was in. Did you ever hear Christians talk about their burden? I got such a burden for so-and-so. I've got really such a burden to pray for him, he'll never come around. What a contradiction of terms. God's burdens are calls to prayer. Someone says, if God ordains everything and God knows already from the beginning, what good will my little prayer do anyway? God already knows, why pray? Will my praying change the will of God? No, my little prayer won't change the will of God. But my little prayer will fulfill the will of God. God's ordained the end, but He's also ordained the means to the end. And just as God has ordained the end, He burdens people to pray on the way so that He can ordain that end. God's ordained how much light I'll have in the Christian life. So do I say, what good will my study do? Why study? God already knows how much light I'll have. God's ordained the means to the end. Brothers and sisters, I hope. Brothers, God's already ordained your life on this planet. What good will your eating do? Why eat? God already knows how long you'll live on the earth. Why sleep? What good will that do? God's ordained the means to the end. Just as studying fulfills the will of God, just as resting fulfills the will of God, just as exercise fulfills the will of God, even though He knows the end, so prayer fulfills the will of God. He burdens you. God puts it on. That isn't unbelief when you're under a burden. It's part of your faith. It's an evidence of your faith. We need to stop being burdened about our burdens and recognize that God lays burdens on His people. And He burdens us so we can, I speak as a fool, burden Him. He puts it on us so we can put it on Him. Cast your burden, that which I've laid on you, on Him. Just turn it back over to Him. Every time you have a burden, that's a call by God to trust God. To take that thing and lay it back on Him. And I'll tell you also that every burden is also a prophecy. God will never prompt your heart to pray for what won't be granted. He's not playing games. He's not fooling around. When God burdens you, That's not a cause for depression. That's a cause for excitement. Because when God puts a burden on you, God is saying, I'm planning to do something about this, and that's why I've laid that burden on you. If God never burdened anything, God wouldn't do anything, because He does things through the vessels that He's burdened. Do you realize this, brothers? So far from burdens being burdens to bring you down, burdens are designed by God to pick you up. They're designed to lift you up. And I believe this, that the greater the burden God lays on His people, and the longer it stays, the greater will be that miracle when God finally lifts that burden. If you're one of those chosen vessels that God has been pleased to lay compounded burdens on, what He's going to do? My, what He's going to do? That's not a sign of unbelief. Habakkuk was frustrated by his burdens and he blamed his faith. And he needed to see that the oracle was from God. He thought because God didn't lift the burden right away, God wasn't listening. You know, it can be awfully frustrating when God delays prayer. I remember reading Kings and with Elijah. Remember the prophets of Baal and how they prayed to their God? It's foolish to pray to a God that's not a God. And then they cried out and they screamed and they cut themselves. He went, hey, maybe he's on vacation. Ha ha ha. But I'll tell you, I've been in the position of those prophets of Baal. It's awfully frustrating to pray to a God that doesn't answer. And you don't know what to do. Now, you don't go into a dance and cut yourself and all the rest. We do other things. We have our own way. And if He doesn't come through, then we cry and then we whine and then we have all-night prayer meetings. Then we go into asceticism and then we discipline our lives and everything to get God to move. But it's an awful burden when God doesn't seem to answer prayer. Habakkuk needed to see. Habakkuk was saying, Lord, I know I'm unbelieving. Look at this. I'm just feeling lousy all the time. I'm burdened about this. That's sin. I'm burdened about it. If I was a Christian, I wouldn't be burdened about it. Yes, you would. That's the whole point of it. And Habakkuk began to see God laid the burden on him. Why dost thou make me see this sin? He said, because I need a vessel. I need someone to pray about that. And you're that vessel. And so Habakkuk says, yeah, but how about this? If I was living by faith, I would see things happen. I'm not seeing anything happen. I don't see any visible movements of God. God is inactive. God is not doing anything. I don't see any miracles. I don't see any conversions. I don't see any signs. I don't see any wonders. I don't see anything happening. I don't even feel God in my soul. When I got saved, it was wonderful. It felt like someone tipped a jug of honey over in my soul. Everything was sweet and everything was nice. And now it's gone. It's been months since I saw lightning fall from the sky and neon signs light up and God tell me which way to go. Nothing's happening. And he says, I know I'm full of unbelief. Man, if I was living in faith, I'd see something. But God, my life is a big, fat nothing. I don't see you moving. Verse 5. Look among the nations. Observe. Be astonished. Wonder. I am doing something in your day. He said, you would not believe it. Even if you were told. God says, you're not seeing anything. But that doesn't mean nothing's happening. I am active. I am doing something. I am not a disinterested spectator sitting off in heaven just watching your life. I'm doing something, and I'm doing something wonderful. You see, Habakkuk was quite hard on his faith. If my faith was real, I'd see God doing something. I'd feel joy. I'd feel peace. I'd see fruit. I'd see something. Habakkuk said, now watch. Here's my argument.
Watch how stupid it is in the light of the New Testament. If I had faith, I would see. All through the Bible, that's put in. We walk by faith, not by sight. And his whole argument is, if I had faith, I would see. The truth is, and it's a hard truth, but the more you get on target with Jesus and the more you know the Lord, the less you're going to see. The less you're going to see. God encouraged Habakkuk by telling him, I am doing something. And then he says, an unbelievable something. I'm doing something, if I told you, you wouldn't believe it, I'm going to tell you. Now, you'd expect something great to follow this. What is God doing that is so unbelievable that if I heard it, I'd say, no, you're not doing that. What is that unbelievable something? Verse 6. Behold, I'm raising up the Chaldeans, that fierce and impetuous people. That's it? That's the unbelievable something? Brothers, really, does that sound so unbelievable? God said, I'm going to tell you something, and when you hear it, you won't believe it's happening. What's so unbelievable about God raising up one nation against another nation? He does that all the time. That's not unbelievable. And yet God said, I am working. You don't see it, but I'm working, and it's so unbelievable that when I tell you, you're not even going to understand it. The New Testament sheds a little light on that verse. It's quoted in the New Testament. It's quoted in Acts chapter 13. Paul is preaching how Pilate had finally ruled that Christ be executed. And then Paul tells about the glorious resurrection of Christ. And then he adds these words. Behold, you scoffers, marvel and perish. For I'm accomplishing a work in your days, a work you would not believe, though someone should describe it to you. What is that unbelievable work? The Chaldeans? No, that's the illustration of the unbelievable work. What's the principle? It's not that God is raising up the Chaldeans, but that God is raising up the Chaldeans to do His will. The unbelievable thing is that God is going to bring good out of evil. That's the unbelievable thing. That God is going to bring good out of evil. As you look around in the world of sin and injustice and oppression and violence and rebellion, God says, I'm working and I'm going to bring good out of that. When you look around and you see the Philippines and the Middle East and Gaddafi, and what's the unbelievable thing? That God's using that for good. That God's in that. He's in the bottom line. Verse 6 says, I'm raising up the Chaldeans. How does He do that? How does God raise up the Chaldeans? You say, well, by instigation. He goes in there and He begins to prompt them to sin. And God goes into the terrorist and He says, today, I want you to bomb. No, we can't lay sin at God's feet. God does not raise up the Chaldeans by instigating them. He does it by forcing them and by coercing them. And He says, you're not going to have a choice today. As you start to go to work, a trance is going to come over you, and suddenly you're going to find yourself taking a bomb in a car. He doesn't do it that way. He doesn't strong arm ever. God says, I'm doing something. It's such a tremendous something, you're not going to believe it when I tell you. I am raising up evil to do good. And how am I raising up that evil? He said, I'm raising up that evil by permitting them. That's how I'm raising them up. By not stopping them. I could stop them. But I'm not going to stop them. I'm going to raise them up by permitting them. If I had faith, I'd see. And God says, faith isn't supposed to see. Faith knows. I am working. And bad things are going to turn into good things. Bad things, may God give us eyes to see it. Bad things exist by His permission in order that good things might be done. If we believed for 10 minutes that that was true, we'd already be in chapter 3. We'd be shouting glory. If we believed that every bad thing in our life was raised up by God, by permission, that's the unbelievable thing. God raised up that accident in your life by permitting it. Say, oh, God's not doing anything. Yes, He is. He raised up that accident by permitting it. God raised up that financial crisis by permitting it. Say, oh, I lost my job, my dog died. God raised up those circumstances by permitting it. And it even goes deeper than that. Some of these things, I don't have the theology for them. I can't explain them theologically. God raised up that broken marriage by permitting it. Say, God's not doing anything in my life. God's doing something in your life. God raised up that disease by permitting it. God raised up that bereavement by permitting it. Even God raised up that shameful fall by permitting it. God raised up all those conflicts. That's unbelievable. That's unbelievable. If I had faith, I'd be seeing something. God says, faith doesn't see. Faith knows I am doing something. I'm doing something so tremendous. You can't believe it. I am using every bad thing in your life for good. I look at a tragedy in life and I say, wow, God's hands are tied. God says, my hands were never more untied. That's exactly what I'm doing. If I'm working, I'd see something, He says. God says, you need to open your eyes and you need to look around. Where's my faith? I never see God working. All I see is Chaldeans. That's it. That's exactly right. So all I see is trouble. Yeah, yeah. You see it? Now you see it, don't you? That's me working. He says, I don't have faith. I don't see. God says, yes, you do. Yes, you do. Third one. Two more, we'll be done. Habakkuk thought his faith was unbelief because he couldn't reconcile his theology with his revelation of Christ. I'll try to explain that. It depends on how you read this book. If you read this chapter, at first you say, he's got problems in his theology. But then when you read it carefully, you'll see that it was his good theology that prompted those questions. He really didn't have problems in his theology at all. His problem was that he knew so much up here. He had great theology, but it wasn't reconciled with what his experience was of his theology. He knew God was just, but his revelation of God wasn't working. Did you ever have that experience in your own life where you know so much about God, and it just seems like words? It's not real. It's not in my life. And I want it to be in my life. I'll say this now, and I'll try to develop it a little bit. Do you realize this? The God you know will always be greater than the God you know. You follow what I'm saying? I know a lot more about God. The God I know, fundamentally, I got my creed down. The God I know is bigger than the God I know. The God I know, sometimes you say, man, he's just so small. Habakkuk was looking to his theology this great big God that he had. And then he looked at his life and he said, man, am I full of unbelief? Am I full of unbelief? Because my theology is bigger than my revelation of Christ. Chapter 1, verse 2, he cries out, how long, Lord? He pictures nations like fish. He said, I don't see any hope. I know you're in charge and I know you're God and I know you're on the throne. But honestly, I don't think anything's ever going to happen. I know what I know, but I don't know that. I don't see it. I don't experience it. And I have no hope that you'll ever do it. All I see, I know you're on the throne, but all I ever see is nations being hooked and nations being dragged by fishermen and being pulled down. And so he says, I have the theology, but I don't believe it. It's not my experience. It's not true. And if I were a man of faith, I wouldn't be so negative. I would agree with my theology. I hate it when I don't agree with me. I hate it when I see it and it's not true in my life. Let me just take a little sideline here and point out a few things in chapter 2, and then we're going to move on and I'll wrap up this principle. Many commentators outline chapter 2 by the five woes that are mentioned. In verses 6 to 8, the woe for expansionism. They never stay at home. They just want to build up their territories. In verses 9 to 11, woe for the sin of greed. And verses 12 and 13, woe for the sin of violence. And 15 to 17, woe for the sin of drunkenness. And 18 to 20, woe for the sin of idolatry. Now, just pointing out those sins doesn't get the point of Habakkuk's heart before us. The point is this. As he begins to write this, he says, I don't see you doing anything. I know my theology, but you're not living up to my theology. Nothing's ever happening. Sin's going to last forever and you're never going to come through. The illustrations he uses in chapter 2 are really brilliant. Again, I won't take time to develop them, but let me just mention the five graphic pictures. God is saying, I'm going to do something. He says, the wicked are like a drunken man. Verse 5. They're deceived. All they get is unreal, and someday they'll sober up and they'll see that they had unreality. And then chapter 2, 6 to 8, he says, the wicked are like the victims of a loan shark. One day the creditors are going to come and repossess everything. And then in verses 9 to 11, he says, the wicked are like those who have built their house with the living things that they've stolen. If you're going to steal anything, don't steal anything with a mouth. It'll squeal on you. And they stole, they were building their house, and all of a sudden the bricks started talking. You stole me from Bill Jones over there, and all the boards started talking, and the bricks and the boards started agreeing, and he was being condemned by everything around him. That's the picture he uses. And then in chapter 2, verse 16, that whole section, the wicked are compared to drunkards standing in a circle passing a drink around. And everybody passes the drink around. He takes it and they're partying. And then in verse 16 he says, the cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you. And utter disgrace will cover your glory. And then finally at the end, verses 18 to 20, the wicked are compared to hopeless idolaters. How foolish it is to trust in a God that is not a God. And in the context, Babylon is trusting Babylon. They're burning incense to their own nets. They're trusting their own right arm, and God says they're idolaters and the cup will come around. Verse 11, they'll be held guilty whose strength is their God. Habakkuk says, I've got a great theology, but I don't see it happening. But what does he see? How does God deal with that? Look at verse 12 of chapter 1. Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We will not die. Thou, O Lord, hast appointed them to judge.
Thou, O rock, has established them to correct. He says, Lord, I don't see that you're ever going to judge the Chaldeans. But I do see an end to our chastening. We will not die. I know, Lord, I don't see all these things I believe. I don't see it. But I do see your mercy. I do see that we will not die. And God says, in effect, man, it's the same thing. I don't understand. You see your chastening coming to an end, but you don't see the rod coming to an end. How's your chastening going to come to an end if the rod doesn't come to an end? You're arguing unbelief, and the very sentence illustrates faith. Here's the point. The very moment Habakkuk was doubting God's judgment, Habakkuk was trusting God's mercy. And he says, my Holy One, we will not die. He had a revelation of Christ. He saw the mercy of the Lord. Had no problem with that. But the rest of his theology didn't come along. I think the point is this. And this is why struggling faith is faith. We've got to walk in the light of the revelation that God has given us. Habakkuk was walking in the light he had. Habakkuk saw that God was merciful. Habakkuk saw, he says, my Holy One, we will not die. This chastening won't last forever. Your grace, he saw that. He was all depressed because he didn't see everything everybody else saw. God hasn't called us. It sounds like a contradiction. God hasn't called us to walk in the light of everything we know in this book. Your theology will always exceed your revelation of Christ. It always will. You'll always know more of God than you know of God. And God has only called you to walk in the light of the revelation that He's given you. When God shines in your heart and God shows you, you walk in that. Don't be so burdened about the God you don't know. Enjoy the God you do know. Walk in the light He's given you. Enjoy Christ there. And then when you're ready, He'll show you more. Don't try to reconcile this whole book and all the theology and all the creeds and everything everybody else says. Don't try to reconcile it. You say, I don't see Him that way. And oh, I must be an unbeliever. You see Him by the way He's shown Himself to you. You walk in that. And don't you go struggling about the rest of that. And so Habakkuk is shown that, in fact, he has light. He sees God. One more, we'll go to lunch. Habakkuk throws up the final proof that he has unbelief. He said, Lord, if I had faith, I wouldn't be passive. Man of God, and he was uninvolved. He wasn't doing anything. If I was a man of faith, I'd be active. I'd be preaching. I'd be visiting. I'd be teaching. You'd have opportunities for me. I'd be zealous. Are you ever a Christian out of action? Oh, man. What's wrong in my life? Everybody else is so involved, and everybody else is running here and there, doing something. Man, I must be a real unbeliever. I don't have a Sunday school class. I don't drive a school bus. I don't tear rags for the missionaries. I don't do anything. And everybody else seems involved. Everybody else doesn't seem to be bothered by the things that bother me. All I see is sin, and all I see is... And I'm a prophet. I'm a man of God. And he couldn't put his finger on anything and say, this is God. He had nothing to join and nothing to link up with. Nothing to become involved in. And he said, oh, I'm a man of unbelief. If I were a man of faith, I'd be involved. And so God deals with him very tenderly. Chapter 2, this is the end of his prayer. He says, I'll stand on my guard post, station myself on the rampart. I'll keep watch to see what he'll speak to me, how I may reply when I'm reproved.
I know I'm going to get kicked for talking like this to God, but I'll just stand around. Then the Lord answered me and said, record the vision. Inscribe it on tablets that the one who reads it may run. The vision is yet for the appointed time. It hastens toward the goal. It will not fail. Though it tarries, wait for it. It will certainly come. It will not tarry. If I were a man of faith, I wouldn't be passive. God says, wait a minute. Waiting is not passive. Waiting is not passive. To act, you got to wait for the appointed time. You got to wait for the vision. You got to wait until God calls you. He says, once you see that, then you'll run. Until you see the vision, you're not going to be able to run. Great truth contained here. God has a will. In this case, the illustration is the Chaldeans. It's for an appointed time. It'll come. King James says, though it tarry, wait for it, it will not tarry. Though it comes at the last minute, wait for it. It will not come a minute too late. The margin here says that it pants for the appointed time. You ever see a dog panting out of breath? God says, my plans, my schedule, my program is panting toward the goal. I'm doing fine. My program's doing fine. It's moving toward the goal. But sometimes you have to wait for that appointed goal. Faith waits. When you go into a restaurant and you see a man or woman standing there in their uniform, we call them waiters or waitresses. Now, you say, wow, what a passive person. What a terrible thing. Come into this restaurant and see these passive people standing all around. A waiter is called a waiter because he waits. But that's active. That's not passive. He's waiting to see if you want coffee. He's waiting to see if you want dessert. He's waiting to see if you want the check. He's waiting to see if you'll tip him. The point is, when we wait before God, if God hasn't shown us what it is He wants us involved in, don't go off for us, oh, I'm not involved, everybody else is doing this, and they're moving there, and their tires are spinning. Say, wait until God puts you into a ministry or into a position. And during that wait, don't you get all discouraged and say, oh, I'm an unbeliever because I'm not involved. Waiting is active. You wait for the Lord, and you got your eyes on the Lord, and you're waiting for that next command. And then you begin to move. And that's why he says in the second verse, record the vision, inscribe it on tablets, that the one who reads it may run. Habakkuk, he said a mouthful. I wish he had believed what he said. And he mixes metaphors there in verse 1. He says, I'm going to keep watch, that has to do with eyes, to see what he'll say. I'm going to keep watch to see what he'll say. He mixes up the eyes and the ears. Habakkuk says, I'm going to watch with my ears. And he touched on a tremendous truth. What he's saying is, until I get the revelation, until I know what God wants me to do, I'm going to wait, and waiting is not passive. When God reveals it, He'll have the occasion to run. Moving toward the song in chapter 3. It's God's will that we all are able to sing that song, though the fig tree, that nothing matters, only having the Lord matters. Some people struggle with faith, and they just have every reason, even beyond Habakkuk, they have every reason to believe that they're just full of unbelief. I want to encourage you, brothers, that are struggling like Habakkuk struggled. I realize there's a possibility that all of this can be abused. Some of you might be burdened because of guilt, not because God's laid a burden on you. Some of you might not be seeing God do anything because God's not doing anything, because you're not open. It's possible that you might be rebelling against the Lord, and you might be inactive because you're plain old lazy. That's possible. I don't want to encourage you guys. In no way. That isn't what God's called us to. But it's a possibility that someone that has struggling faith that's very precious to God has looked at all of his burdens and he hasn't seen that God has put those burdens on him. God has put it on. And God sees that as faith. God's encouraging you. God's calling you to trust Him. And you need to see that. You don't need to see visible things in order to know God is working. Everything God allows in your life, you can live by faith. God has called us to walk in the light that He's given us. And you might be in a holding pattern. He might just be saying, wait, wait. Don't think that's unbelief. Lay hold of God. All right. Tonight, tomorrow, we'll look at the song. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word. And we just pray, Lord, for anyone struggling with faith, by your light we might see that you've accepted that desire to believe. Take us on, we pray, toward the song.